Okay, so I'm going to talk about experimental work we did in Leiden, and I should reassure you. I'm not yet a geophysicist. I mean, I started out doing mathematical physics, and then I did theoretical physics, and now I do experiments. So, it may be sort of a natural progression to go to more and more applied things. But this will be about real experiments in slow granular flows, and the work is mainly done by these people that are listed here, and this picture illustrates basically the main idea of our experiments. So what has happened here, there has been an earthquake and there is a fault zone here, and so the ground has slipped like this, and actually on top of this slip you see there's a pile of granular materials here, and it sort of has sheared, and this is actually precisely the geometry that we will use. So what we're really doing is shearing material in sort of modified couette cells. And this is just a little bit the outline. So there's two different varieties you can think of. And the simplest thing you can think of is just taking a drum. So think just of a drum like this. You rotate the drum, but at the bottom you keep a disc of radius RS for R slip fixed. And so what happens along this split in the bottom, you have a discontinuity, of course, and this will drive the granular flow. And so what you do, you fill this drum with sand up to a layer height H, and you just initially just look from above with a video camera and look at the flow profiles. And actually, we started doing out this experiment in sort of a modified couette geometry where you have also an inner cylinder present. And it turns out for many cases you don't need this, so this is sort of a slightly simpler geometry. But there's also some fun to be had if you look in this geometry.
The middle bit is always fixed.
In my case, the middle bit is always fixed. Now, I should also say that the rotation rates are so slow that there are no inertial effects of centrifugal forces, and if you do it the other way around, as we've done in some cases, there's no difference. It's just a trivial symmetry. And the reason we do this is just some sort of experimental historical thing. And I will discuss a couple of different things. So I will first look at what happens if you have a relatively shallow layer of sand. I'll make that more precise. And in that regime, we'll find shear zones which are very universal, which have a very simple form, and which are also quite wide. And this is somewhat older work. And then I will go on describing what happens actually when you make this layer deeper and deeper, because all sort of things happen. So what happens in this case is that you get some precession, and in this case you get localization of the shear bands. All of this will be made more precise. And then at the end of the talk, I will say a little bit what happens in three dimensions. Look at the velocity profile inside the material, and also the packing density, and say also a little bit about models that have attempted to model this system.
What is the size of it? It's not the best
size.
I've seen it already.
You're fast. Okay. Yeah. Well, this, right? I mean the.
Jesus.
No. There's. This is one example. I mean, actually, what we do. This is now a top view of the setup. Actually, you can vary the radius of this disc by mounting different things in your setup, but this is roughly the scale. So it's really a thing like this. You can put it on your tabletop. And what we've done here we put a layer of roughly 60 millimeter of grains. So this is sort of somewhere between shallow and deep, as will become clear. And this red circle indicates where at the bottom your stationary disc is. And we just colored the surface grains. So we just sprinkled some black colored grains at the surface, so it's easy for you to see what happens. And so if you now start running the thing, this is what happens. Don't worry, this seems to be part of the PowerPoint. So what you see is that first of all, the shear, which is mainly here, is sort of away from where the split position in the bottom was. And also what you see is that actually you get a fairly wide flowing zone. These grains are roughly 1 millimeter in size, and so this is maybe like 30 or 50 grain diameters. And this is of course the first surprise, and that's actually the whole motivation for this work, because normally people will tell you if you shear granular materials you get a very narrow shear band, and the shear band is of 5 to 10 grain diameters wide, and so it's hard to model it by continuum models, and so we're stuck in a sense. And I think the importance of this work is that we'll show that there is a whole regime where you can make very wide, very smoothly flowing granular materials, for which no good models exist.
Can you point out in the picture what you consider to be the shear zone?
Yeah, well, it's a bit a vague concept, but it would be from here to here, I think, right? This whole part, the grains have been flowing past each other. Now, of course, you know, there's no sharp end, right? I mean, this has become clear now. I think there's never any part in the cell that is really stationary, but you just have to wait for a ridiculously long time to see anything flowing there.
Can you say what the particles were?
Yeah, these are glass beads, 1 millimeter glass beads.
And some of them, how did you get the black one?
We colored them with a felt. It's fairly low tech, you know, and that doesn't seem to be important. And that's also not how we take our real data. All right, so this is only for illustration of what's going on.
Is it absolutely clear that it's a broad shear band rather than a narrow shear band moving in or moving out? What would leave the same result?
Well, I would say look at it again. Now, I don't know if I can get this thing to play again because somehow the display switches back and forth. Okay, there we go. Maybe I should try to stop it. So I would say initially what you see is really a profile like this, and it just extends like that. And that's also what we measured. But that's, you know, it's, if you see this for the first time, it may take, you know, essentially in the beginning you already see sort of what the velocity profile is, and now it just gets smeared out. Okay. So what we'll find is basically, oh, God damn it, this is interesting. So yeah, this is what I wanted to show. So what we're doing in the end, we will measure the azimuthal velocity as a function of radius. And we do that with sort of a variation of particle image velocimetry, which is a standard technique. And we are helped by the system being relatively simple. So first of all, we find that the velocity profiles are rate independent in the sort of regime where we're driving. So if you rotate the thing twice as fast, you essentially get the same velocity profile, but just with a prefactor 2. And this sort of holds over a quite considerable range. So we don't have to worry about the real driving rate. And the driving rate, I mean, the movie I showed you is more or less real time. So that gives you the idea how slowly you're turning the thing. Secondly, when you start the experiment, there are some transients, of course, but they're very short. And essentially, after a second or so, there's nothing you can detect. So the thing becomes time independent. So you just have a very steady and simple flow. And also, the flow is essentially purely in the azimuthal direction. You know, there are essentially no radial flows.
So how long are the transients? I mean, if inertia is not important, this must be due to some rearranging in the packet.
Yeah, and so it essentially, for relatively shallow layers, I think it has to do with, you just have to build up a sufficient amount of strain. So you want to have a strain, let's say, of order 1 over your shear band. And then more or less,
it's all dilated.
It is dilated and also becomes anisotropic. So if you reverse the shearing direction, then you clearly see there is a clear transient. And actually what happens, the material initially recompacts and then expands and does all these sort of things. But it's gone after a few seconds. If you look at very deep layers, it can take much longer. But we'll get to that later. So now the velocity being very simple, at least the average velocity, I will not look at the fluctuations of the individual grain velocities here, I just look at the average velocity field. We can define a non-dimensional velocity parameter, omega, as a function of the radius r, and omega is simply defined as the ratio of the azimuthal velocity divided by the the angular velocity divided by the rotation rate. So if this thing is 0, the grains don't move. If this thing is 1, they co-move with the driving, and everything in between is obviously what you expect it to be. So we will look at these velocity profiles. And this is the first series of profiles that I show you for the very simple case where we just have this rotating bucket and we have a stationary disk here. And what you see here are these velocity profiles. So for small radii, indeed, the velocity is 0 here because basically the material rests on this stationary bottom disk. And near the outer ring, which is here at 110, I think, all the material is co-moving with the rotation. And now for finite heights, these are the sort of profiles that you get. So these are profiles ordered by increasing layer height. So the most shallow one here is a layer of 3 millimeters, so that's only like 3 or 4 beats. So, you know, that's not something where you can expect much continuum dynamics. But then if you make your layer thicker and thicker, and you look at the velocity profile at the surface, you get these broader and broader shear zones, right? So that's the way that you make them broader. You just make a deeper layer. The other thing that you see is that sort of the location of the shear zone moves inward with increasing layer height. And I already showed you this one example where, you know, the movie where I showed you the shear zone was really not straight above the crack in the bottom, but it was more towards the center.
Okay. How does it come that the profiles cut each other for shallow?
Well, this is there's no reason why they shouldn't. This is not one experiment, right? These are many different experiments. So what happens is when you would look from the top, let my hand be now the velocity profiles, and I increase the height of the surface. So initially, the thing essentially only becomes broader, and then it also starts to move inwards more. And so there's no physical significance, I think, to the fact that they intersect here.
But there's a lot of significance to the fact that the whole assembly of profiles is so non-symmetric.
I mean, that's why the depth is significant compared to RS.
That's one thing. The other thing is that the ring that is moving is small.
That doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. Boundary effects are completely not here. But let me.
Boundary effects are clearly big because otherwise that profile would be symmetric.
No.
Compared to the interior radius.
Well, okay. We will get to all these issues. First of all, these profiles are actually symmetric themselves. But you're talking about why the thing is moving inward. Mm. Right. The reason it's moving inward is actually, this was the reason we started doing the experiment, but it turns out to be a triviality. Basically, what happens if you have a couette cell, and if you have a piece of chalk, maybe. I should draw it here because Robin asked the question. So. If you have a geometry like this, and you try along concentric rings, try to balance the shear stress as you have to do, you know, you find that basically the shear stresses are larger here. You have to balance the total stress, but it's just a 1 over R effect. So you can imagine, this is a bit hand-waving, but near the inner, if you lower the radius, the shear rate is higher, the shear stresses are higher. Right. Now, of course, I don't know what my stress profile is in this system. And in a sense, what I'm doing is making a complicated stress profile but getting simple velocities out. This is the trade-off. But still, this is the reason that the thing goes inward. This is the radius of curvature. And this I also will become much more clear. I mean, we have a scaling relation, et cetera, et cetera. Igor?
Do we have any convection?
There is very small convection, but it's really very small. So what you can do, if I look at the surface and I look at the radial velocities, they're usually around my noise floor. And that means that they're certainly less than 1%. And I think they're much smaller. We did some more accurate things. And I think typically they are of the order 10⁻³. So there's not much convection going on. And it may depend a little bit on the grain sizes. I mean, for spherical particles, it's very small in any case. If you make very irregular particles or you use bird seeds, you know, we've thrown all sort of stuff in this setup, then sometimes you tend to see a little bit more. And also the surface doesn't remain flat. But for smooth glass beads, actually everything stays flat. There's almost no convection. And it's really, really simple.
But if the steady profile is three-dimensional.
Oh, yeah. There's a complicated 3D structure, and you have to bear with me for a while before I get there. But
if the profile is in general three-dimensional, you should have just some continuous function, some kind of vertical.
No, I don't think so. But this is something we discuss later, either in or outside of the talk. I mean, certainly the scale on which convection happens is completely different from the scale where you see the sort of shear flex. No, also not there. And that is okay. For shallow layers, we did some very poor man's tomography, which I show you. But also, in the meantime, we have done some better MRI. The group of Heinrich Jaeger and Sid Nagel in Chicago has also done MRI studies of the velocity profile. And convection is small for shallow layers. For deep layers, it kicks in.
Okay.
for very deep layers. Okay, but so back to, we're only at the beginning of this talk. So the thing I wanted to start with is just look at these velocity profiles here. And here basically is actually from a slightly different run. I mean, here the, here the slip radius was at 95 millimeters and here's at 85 millimeters, but it doesn't matter much. And what I've plotted here is actually for all heights from 3 to 43 millimeters or something like that, these profiles. And of course, what you seem to see is that they all have the same shape up to a scale factor and a center position. And so I made this cheesy movie to show just how you can rescale them. And it's really to stress a point. This is all raw data, and the only thing I do is try to put them on top by using two fit parameters. And it works extremely well, right? And it, of course, this is, I think, still the biggest surprise in this system. You know, nothing in granular material should work as well, right? And I really, this is, you know, every individual curve is like 200 data points or something, and there's like 30 of them. So there must be something going on, and we still don't understand this. But since we have so much data, we can, of course, look in more detail at what really the functional form here is. Because so
that was just an offset and a scale.
This is just an offset, yeah. So what I basically done, I just, you know, put them all, shift them, and then stretch them. Because these are the two obvious scales there, but there's nothing else there. That's the point. And so if you look at this function in detail, it actually turns out it's an error function. And the error function is, you know, it's the integral of the Gaussian, right? And so it turns out that you can write all these velocity profiles, omega r, essentially, you know, you have these two factors, a half for normalization because you want to go from 0 to 1, but the heart of the matter is this error function, and it's a function of r minus the center location of my shear zone. This is one parameter that I have, and the width of my shear zone.
Yeah.
This, everything is at the surface still. And one way to really check this is that, well, you know, at some point when I go to the inner when I go to small radii, the velocity becomes very small. And measuring very small velocities is very simple, because what you do, you just sit there with your video camera and you take frames with very long time in between, and you can see essentially arbitrary small velocities. So by doing that, we've been able to measure in this tail the velocity essentially over six decades. Fitting the velocity profile with an error function just on this scale, and you see it, you know, it just works fantastically well.
So right? Doesn't this give a kink in the profile at the origin for when
it does, but that you don't see that here. I mean, a half is somewhere here, right? So the center of the shear zone is here, and so you don't see that.
No, but I mean when the center of the shear zone has actually disappeared, so to speak.
What do you mean disappear?
When it's deeper.
Oh, we will get. Oh.
And then you
wait. Now, then, when you go really deep, it becomes asymmetric, and all sort of other stuff kicks in. This is for shallow layers, so there's a limited range where this works. But in that range, it works really well.
I mean, how strong does your center of the shear zone deviate from the position of the?
We'll get to that. There's a scaling law, so there's a very precise law for that also. And actually, this is what I'm going to do now, because what I haven't said, which I also should say, that this actually also holds for various materials. If you change the grain size, well, then the width, of course, of the shear zone is changing. But if you take either spherical particles, very monodisperse, or spherical polydisperse, or, you know, irregular bronze beads, you always find this error function. And so it seems to be a very strong, robust result. This is the way it is.
Lambda
is this rescale parameter. I should have said that. When I replot all the data, I plot it now as function, actually, of this parameter, which is the rescaled radial coordinate. And then you can compare it to an error function. W is the width.
That's subject to some interpretation, precisely what you mean by the width.
Well, it's you would say, the way I think about it, at this stage, this fit defines this parameter. Because indeed, since this is, if this tail really holds up, right, I mean, which you seem to do pretty well, now there's, you know, the shear never stops. It's everywhere, but, you know, it falls off like a Gaussian, right? I mean, so at some point but that's the way I define my width. And so actually, so this fit defines both my center location and my width. And these ones I will look at now. So first, to the center location that Thorsten was also asking about. So, you know, essentially what you do is put a cut here and look where this thing is. What you really do, of course, is make your fit. But once your profiles are symmetric, it doesn't really matter. And then you can plot this center location as function of the height. And that's what I've done here. And I've done it for different values of the slip radius. So if my slip radius is at 95 millimeters, of course, for a very shallow layer, that's where my shear zone is, and then it moves inward. Okay, so if you want to geometrically interpret this, you should rotate the thing and think of it like this. You know, this is really, this blue curve is essentially this curve, and it tells you when I make a layer of this height and I look at the surface, this is where my shear zone is. And now the nice thing is that if you do this for different disks, you know, you get these different curves. And if you do it for different particle sizes, different particle shapes at the same radius, you get the same curve. So this center location is really doesn't care about what sort of particles you use.
You said particle, different particle sizes.
Particle sizes and shapes, polydispersities, all these sort of things. And the thing that is really surprising is that it's fit by a very simple scaling rule. And the way to think about this is it's easiest to think in the sort of, for me at least, in the real system. So what I want to think about is how much has this shear zone shifted from its location from RS. So this is RS minus RC, right? And now I have to think, you know, what are the obvious length scales in my system, the macroscopic length scales? And one of them is obviously RS. So if I non-dimensionalize this one with RS and then also non-dimensionalize the height by RS, I get this relation. So I get an exponent 5 over 2, and I have no idea where it comes from. And the most surprising thing probably is that the prefactor here is 1, you know, at least within a percent or something. So by this very simple scaling law, I can tell you for any sort of particles that I use, you know, once you have RS and H, I can tell you precisely where the shear zone is located. Okay? And this also, you know, this is, I think, equally surprising. So now you see what I mean with universality, in a sense. You know, the profiles are very robust, and also their locations are very robust. You know, with I can predict them now from this.
So
yeah.
What degree of accuracy do you think that exponent has?
The exponent, I don't want to say too much about it. I think later I actually show something on a log-log plot. And of course, in the end, you know, you only scale over less than a decade, right? So the thing is, this is an empirical fit. I can, you know, it's clearly not 2 and it's clearly not 3, and I haven't been able to find any better fits.
Okay.
And there's actually some other theoretical predictions, you know, which are pretty close, but they're off. And I can see that in the data, and I'll show that in the end. So
is everything independent of the outer diameter?
Yes, yes, it is. I mean, so we've done actually, okay, so we've done some things with an other outer diameter, but you also can do if your disk is small. You know, the material here is essentially stationary, and you could even, you know, put some objects there in the sand, and it doesn't influence the shear zone at all.
Are you rotating the outer?
I'm rotating the outer one.
So it's not really, you call it stationary, are you in the rotating frame? Is that everything?
No. This is really, I mean, this is where the outer radius is, and here my, okay, yes. It was not shearing. It's co-moving with the outer. You're right. So this material here, right, is essentially co-moving with the outer cylinder.
And
absolutely.
Calling that a large omega, right?
That is the omega is one range, and there's no strain rate there, and you know where you put this outer diameter doesn't seem to matter. So in principle, you could also do this experiment just in a large layer of sand, and you just bury, you know, a rotating disc in there, right? I mean, then you just rotate the disc instead of rotating the outer bucket, but then you have essentially an infinite layer, and that doesn't make any difference as far as I can tell.
So the requirement for that is that the center, the RC, has to decrease faster than the width increases.
Yes, that's right. So if you that's a very good point. So if you take this thing very close to the outer rim, then of course the thing spreads out and it hits sort of the outer wall, and that we always try to avoid. And of course, you can say, well, but there's always this tail that's hitting it, okay, and that has a very small effect, which we cannot measure. Okay? So now on to the width. The situation is a bit more messy. The width depends on particle size, of course, obviously, but it also depends on particle shape. So, for instance, if I compare the width as function of height for irregular bronze particles of 1.1 millimeter average size, and similarly sized glass beads, then the irregular ones have a smaller width. You know, and there's no, this is more tricky to quantify. And of course, also most of the mixtures that you get, you have some polydispersity, and the polydispersity usually changes with particle sizes, and it's, you know, not so easy for us to get very similar guys. Nevertheless, what you can do, you can first of all look just at the raw data, so the width as function of height, on a log-log scale, again on this, you know, pretty small scale you have here. This thing seems to grow with an exponent which is roughly 2 over 3. It's certainly faster than a square root and smaller than linear, right? That's the main point. And actually this 2 over 3 turns out to be pretty good, as you will see later. And so here I tried to collapse all this data by saying, well, you know, I have to now rescale my width and my height by probably a microscopic scale, by a grain scale, right? And now I don't really know if I have a mixture somewhere between 250 and 400 micron, what grain scale to take. So I just, you know, instead of putting D here, I just put some sort of microscopic length scale L, and I just try to get these guys to fit on a power law, which essentially you can always do. But what you find is that these characteristic lengths for the material are reasonable. Okay, they are within this range, and they seem to be, it seems to work reasonably well. But I really, you know, this is far less precise than the situation for the center zone.
So this implies that as h increases, the width does not become independent of h.
No, the width always increases until you get into a different regime. So you never get into a height-independent regime. The height always plays a role.
Does it make sense to introduce the length scale and the approximate equal to, if you have W over L equals H over L to 2 thirds and that defines L, or do you want approximate, do you get rid of the L and have non-dimensional?
Well, what you want to do is just plot H over D here, where you know what D, what your grain diameter is. And you know, what we're trying to do now at the moment actually is just getting different glassware which are more monodispersed, so you really can do it. But once you have this wide range, you just don't know what your characteristic length is. And so you could think of it another way around. You could say, well, this is some way to define my characteristic length, right? And then I see if these numbers are reasonable. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
It looks reasonable over, again, a quite limited range. So really, I mean,
yeah,
roughly. I mean. Okay, so to wrap this up, for shallow layers, and it will become more precise what shallow means, but essentially this is in terms of the layer height should be half or less the slip radius, it turns out. That's roughly the criterion. You find that your velocity profile is given by this very simple error function, and for convenience I will refer to it now as the normalized error function, which normalized to suit my needs, as a function of this rescaled radial coordinate. I have then two parameters that for a certain velocity profile quantify the precise velocity profile. For the center location, I have this scaling relation, which is independent of the particles. So it's really something that happens on the macroscopic scale. And for the width of the shear zones, I have roughly this scaling relation. And here, the width is independent of the slip radius. So the width is really a microscopic effect, and whether I do it for a small or a large slip radius, it doesn't care. Okay? So these things very nicely decouple in sort of the simplest way they could do it. Okay, so this is sort of for shallow layers.
You mentioned all this, all rate independent.
Okay. This is all also rate independent. And so we...
Is there upper limit to how fast?
Well, what we've done, there's more an upper limit at the moment experimentally. So we try to go as fast and as slow as we could. And as fast as we could is probably a factor roughly 10 faster than what you saw there. So then you probably get close to a rotation every 4 seconds. So you're doing something like this. Then what you see is that the width starts to sort of broaden, and also the center location appears to be shifting somewhat. But I'm not quite sure if this is due to the rate or just due to the fact that you get additional vibrations in your system. But if you go slower, so if we can also roughly go a factor of 10 slower than what I've shown you here, nothing changes. So, you know, and this, what we're doing now is actually building a much cleaner setup where hopefully we have far less vibrations and can sweep over a larger velocity range. Because at some point, when you go really fast, you're getting out of the quasi-static regime. And that is interesting. So that's what we are thinking of for the future. But here we're in quasi-statics, I think. Okay. So now let's look at what happens for deep layers. And I'm sorry that the movies get isolated. What this is a continuation of the previous movie, but now sped up by a factor of 100 and for longer times. And actually, you know, I don't know if you saw it in the original movie. I draw your attention to the shear zone here, but actually the core was rotating very slowly. So here in the middle now is a part which appears to be rotating slowly, while at the bottom there's still a stationary disk. So what happens when you start to get this is that the flow becomes really even more three-dimensional now. There's also shear in the Z direction.
This is the lab frame of reference?
This is the lab frame of reference. And I should have said, you know, basically the movie was made such that you roughly have one snapshot per rotation of the outer ring. So that's why I see sort of the stroboscopic effect of the outer ring.
So the inner part is moving slowly because it's just being slightly dragged.
Yes.
Along.
Yes, that's what happened. So you have now, instead of having sort of a completely stationary pile of sand sitting on this inner disk, which is the case for shallow layers, you know, this thing certainly at the top slowly starts to rotate. And it's reasonable because if you make a deep layer, you know, the material at the top feels more, you know, the side than the bottom, so at some point it has to rotate, right? So that's how you can understand it. And now we can also quantify it. So if we get back here, so now we get back to these velocity profiles that I showed you before, and now instead of focusing on the velocity profiles for shallow layers, we go to deeper layers. And, you know, these, to give you an idea of the scales, this is at 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, and 70 millimeters of height. And these are now individual curves where you just increase the layer height by a millimeter. So what you see is that at some point, when you approach the center, so if you go to small radius, you start to see that this thing sort of levels off. And that means that the core is rotating. Okay? And here you see again snapshots from this movie before. And now we can measure this, and what you find is that, again, of course, where this core rotation sets in depends on the slip radius. So if you take a small disk at the bottom, you only need a relatively shallow layer for the precession to set in. And that's what you see here for these three different slip radii. And of course, you should, again, non-dimensionalize your height again by the slip radius, and then you see that these three curves for the precession all nicely fall on top of each other. Right, so that means now I can sort of say more precisely what I mean with shallow layers and deep layers. Shallow layers is where h over rs is less than a half. They're essentially the core precession, you know, is undetectable and doesn't play a role. But then I get into this other regime, which are the deeper layers, where you get a lot of precession. Okay. What you also see, and that's not so obvious here, but maybe you see it already a little bit here, you know. These velocity profiles are very symmetric. So if you flip left and right and flip omega, you get precisely the same velocity profile. But that symmetry is broken here. And it's quite subtle. You don't immediately see it in the data. This is an example out of this previous data set of a height of 58 millimeters. The gray curve here is now the original data. Again, plotted as function of the rescaled coordinate. And the dashed line is now the one where I basically both flip, let's say, the x-axis and the y-axis. And for the shallow layers, these ones are completely equal, so they're symmetric. But before you start to see this precession, you already see some asymmetry of the velocity profiles coming in. And initially, I thought that neither of these two effects were of much interest. I mean, they're just, you know, subtle things that come in when you go to deeper layers, and why care about it? But actually, quite recently, we realized that both the asymmetry and the precession sort of signify one underlying change in the sort of flow modes. And so the way to see that is as follows. Start again with these velocity profiles. Now, what I've told you before is that for shallow layers, you know, this omega essentially looks as an error function times a linear function. But of course, I could say, well, I could turn the thing around. These velocities always span sort of the range from 0 to 1, or maybe less. So in principle, I can always write my omega as this normalized error function times some sort of, you know, of a certain scaling function, sort of rescaled radial coordinates. For shallow layers, this is a linear function. And I can ask myself what happens for deep layers. And so what we do, we take these velocity profiles and take then the inverse normalized error function on them. And, you know, this is somewhat tricky because error functions, you know, they fall off like a Gaussian here, so they fall off very rapidly. So you only can do this over a limited range. So roughly, I mean, your individual error here is of an order of percent. So you can do this over a limited range. But what you see is the following. And this is really nice. So these are now the velocity profiles where I've taken this inverse error function. And what do I get? For shallow layers, where the velocity profile itself is an error function, this chi function is, of course, a linear function. And that's a linear function we've seen before. This is the thing where we say, well, chi is essentially r minus rc over w. So here's linear. But then for deep layers, you see that this thing starts to curve. And somewhat, what is the miracle, is that you can fit all these curves, essentially, by only incorporating one extra term for chi r. Here it's a linear fit, so we need a naught plus a1r, which you can rewrite, of course, in this form if you wish. And then when you go to deep layers, what you find is that there is a cubic term coming in. This is completely, you know, not what you expect. And first of all, of course, the first thing you should do is try to fit it with a quadratic term. And it turns out that the quadratic really doesn't capture this behavior here. And the cubic does much better. And I don't understand why that is. I mean, I would like to dream up some sort of symmetry argument, but I can't. I should also say that this fit is not perfect. If you look very carefully, but you cannot even see that on that scale, you see that there are some deviations, in particular in sort of the intermediate regime between here and here. So, you know, it's somewhat an empirical way to capture what's going on. But I think it gives you some understanding of what's going on, why you both have the asymmetry and the core precession going in. Because think now as follows. Of course, if I would have the real curves extending all the way here, right, for shallow layers, you know, I expect this linear curve here. But of course, by symmetry, I also need to have a linear curve here. So they somehow have to connect up here.
Have you tried directly? So you had your over equals a half plus a half of r minus rc over w. Have you tried directly symmetrizing that?
That is completely symmetric there.
No, it's not symmetric. So if you had Earth of r minus rc over w plus Earth of minus r minus.
Yeah, and what you can do there is that you write it. Essentially, that doesn't work. So what you say is basically, you know, I have one shear zone here and I have one shear zone here, and I should add them up.
Yeah.
Right. That doesn't give you it. That's a very good point. And this is a much stronger effect. So you can also, if you remember these movies, you know, what you saw, if that would be the case, what you're saying is that the two tails of the shear zone start to hit each other.
Yeah.
But then you would expect already to see quite some shear there. And you see for a long time that this inner core is just rotating as a solid blob. So that the value of the shear rates are very small. So it flats off a lot in the middle. But essentially this is what happens somehow. These two tails are reaching each other. And that's sort of the argument I was trying to make. For shallow layers, you know, this chi function, a xi function will go down here. You know, and it goes down here, and there's probably some crossover here, but, you know, if xi r is minus 6, then you have error function of minus 6, and, you know, no one can measure that. But at some point, of course, these guys, you know, they have to sort of cross over, and this is the way they're doing it. And the first thing it means, if they cross over, this function becomes a nonlinear function, and hence the velocity profiles become asymmetric. And at the same time, you also get a finite value here on this axis. And this value here, if you take the error function of this, you get your precession. So precession and asymmetry are just, you know, manifestations of this transition, you could say.
And if you just try to make it outer versus make it inner as the new variable, would that help?
So what we initially did was just doing a four parameter fit where we said, well, we just say this is an error function now, right? So it has a different scale. You can do that, and then you also, in addition, you still need a term. Yeah, but you also need a term for the asymmetry. So what you can do, it's not symmetric there if you take that out. So that's actually what we originally did, you know, which is, it's just the most boneheaded thing that you can do. So you say basically I take Well, you know, you thought of it, in 5 minutes. It took us much longer to even think about this. So what you do is something like this, and then you here have error function of our, well, let's call it lambda now. And then actually you also need something like error function of lambda squared, right? That's sort of, you make an expansion. This works. There's a prefactor here. Now I have four parameters, right? So I spent like days and days to make sure that my fits were reasonable. It becomes quite messy. And what you actually see then is that if you approach sort of the deep layers, the asymmetry becomes quite large. There's some sort of maximum for S here. For the function to be monotonic, and you reach that maximum stage. And then also what you see is that it works quite well for sort of the intermediate range, but when you get close to these deep layers, it doesn't work so well anymore. And now you can understand this, because really we have a cubic term. If I expand this cubic around sort of R unequal to zero, of course in lower order I get a quadratic term here, so that's all fine. But if I really go to the center, this doesn't work so well anymore. So this is quite nice. So I've reduced it now from 4 fit parameters to 3, which of course is always good, and it seems to work better as a result. Okay.
Is the fact that that's cubic required by symmetry? In other words, the direction has to be, you couldn't have a quadratic.
Well, actually not. I think actually it's much easier to argue for a quadratic one.
I mean, it's not sort of symmetric
there
anyway, because it's got the A there.
Well, it's no, that's okay. But the thing is, the real thing is that, of course, suppose now that we could get this chi, also for negative R. So then this function just has to look smooth like this, right? And this is around R is 0, and this is now this chi. So you would expect something like only even powers to come in. Right, so this thing can never work over the whole range, and so again, what this is a quite good empirical fit that fits my data, but this is not the true form. But it's, for all intents and purposes, I cannot fit it any better. But there must be some other function here, right, which then for deeper and deeper layers starts to look linear, and I don't know what it does here, which gives you the real behavior, and that one has to be symmetric. So therefore it's quite annoying that it works like this, and I don't understand why this is. Now just to interpret this a little bit more, so this is now quite hairy, but you can plot now these fit parameters as a function of the height. Here it's done for two different values of the slip radius, and it's such a mess that I advise you not to look at it, but look at this curve. Of course, again, the relevant height scale is a non-dimensional one, and so there shouldn't be millimeter here, obviously, because this is non-dimensional. And then these prefactors A1 and A3, well, they have dimensions of inverse length and inverse length cubed, and if you take this two-third power law for the scaling of the width into account, you can make them non-dimensional, and it works. So what you find here, these are A1, so the linear prefactor for two different cases, and this is the A3. And so what you see is that, for shallow layers, I only have the linear coefficient. For deep layers, I only have the cubic coefficient. And here, there is some crossover regime. And what is also surprising is that the linear one really, boom, seems to go to zero. And we don't know, is this a real transition, or is this... I would have expected just some crossover where this one just happily would sort of flatten out. And that's not what I see. I don't know what that means, and if it means anything. Well, I'm not sure, but it seems to work. I mean,
I just thought that you're naive. You just because of some work that you've done. I mean, the scaling of these widths with depth. You could have 2/3 in your top layer.
Yeah.
You might have something logarithmic. I mean, just.
Oh, you could have anything. Yeah. I mean, the only thing I'm saying. No, the only thing that you should turn it around. You say okay, so I come up with this. With this, exponent, and it's over a crappy range, and so, does it make any sense? And so if you think about now how you should rescale these ones, if that would be the right length scale, then this is the way to do it, it turns out, and it works very well. And so this I see as sort of additional support for the fact that actually this 2/3 exponent may not be so stupid after all. Because over this limited range that I showed you, if it would be crossing over from a square root to a linear function, you cannot really distinguish it. And maybe that's still what's happening here also. I don't know. It just seems to be an effective way to rescale your data. But the point is here now that basically I have these two regimes, and that's what sort of the this sheet again stresses. So for shallow layers, I have something which is linear here, and for deep layers, I have something which is cubic. And there is a difference in the symmetries. Here, this thing is linear, and we know that this RC, or that this prefactor here, depends essentially on my slip radius. That means if I take a system with a certain fixed height, but I take a different slip radius, what happens is that my shear zones just gets translated. But apart from that, it's precisely the same. So it's really a local mode in the sense that for shallow layers, the shear zones really don't know where the center of your cell is. They don't care about that. And for deep layers, this is completely the other way around. Since you don't have a linear term here, but a cubic term, of course, they know, you know, they know damn well where the center is. That's the whole point of them. So, you know, it is really a change in the sort of symmetries of the shear zones, and it's really a change, I think, in the underlying physics. For shallow layers, you have something which is quite local, you know, which...
Except that the position is...
Yeah, I was going to say that. So the position of the shear zone for shallow layers still cares about the global scale. But once you are within that shear zone, its width doesn't depend on it, and its spatial profile doesn't depend on it, and essentially this is a linear, or this is a local phenomenon. While for deep layers, you know, this doesn't hold anymore, and you get something which is much more like a global shear mode. And I think that's the thing that's underlying this asymmetries and the precession. So there's really sort of a quantitative change. And the question whether this is a sharp transition or not is very much open. And it may be amusing to point out that the Chicago group has also looked at these deep shear zones with MRI. And so they can really look in the material and look at all sort of other properties of the velocity that I will not get into. And they seem to think that there is a sharp transition there. Mm-hmm. And it's very close to where we see sort of, you know, the linear coefficient going to zero. But it's open. We don't really know it at this point.
Have you done deeper layers?
Even deeper. If you make them very deep, you cannot really measure them here. But what happens is that just the whole surface co-moves with your rotating layer, and the whole shear zone has ducted below the surface. And I have some MRI images of that, maybe not even in this talk, but everything closes than underneath. And so there's nothing to measure at the surface, so we stop there. Okay. So this is what we got for deep layers. I've said this now a million times, so let's skip that. I want to say a little bit about what happens when you have an inner cylinder present. Because essentially, that is almost, you could say, the classical Couette cell. And you would expect that there's not so much to be discovered there. I mean, of course, we have this split here. And that means that for shallow layers, of course, I have a velocity profile like this. But if I increase my height, I just bump into the inner cylinder. And, you know, this profile that I get here looks precisely the same as the velocity profile that I would get for a pure Couette cell. And people have beat that problem to death. So, you know, there should not be anything interesting there. But fortunately, there is, I think. So, again, these are now the profiles that I see as a function of height. And you see basically that for heights bigger than sort of 60 millimeters here, I don't see any difference. But now, as I told you, we can measure these tails roughly over six decades. So what happens if you do that, life becomes slightly more interesting. So first of all, what you see here now is for shallow layers, essentially you still see something which has an error function like tails or a Gaussian tail, which then bumps into some sort of asymptotic profile here. And this is sort of the profile that you get for truly deep layers. So now we look at a very localized shear zone, and we see that as a function of height, we get to some sort of asymptotic profile here. The point is that this thing is straight. It's an exponential tail. While in the previous case, I always find Gaussian tails, here I find an exponential tail. And for those of you familiar with earlier work, also in the Chicago group, where they looked at this tail, they claimed that if you change sort of the shape of your particles or the polydispersity of your particles, you may go from a more Gaussian to a more exponential tail. Well, that's true when you look here. That's true when you look over the first 1.5 decades. And you see that the thing here is not straight. But asymptotically, it turns out, you always have an exponential. Whether it's polydisperse or monodisperse or irregular grains, it doesn't matter. So that is somewhat of a surprise. And even more surprising is now when you start to look at, you know, the decay rate. Because you would expect, of course, that this, you know, the only microscopic scale, you would say, well, it's the grain diameter. So if I vary my grain diameter, you know, this exponential tail should vary. That's the normal thing that you expect. And that doesn't seem to be the case, although I should be a little bit more cautious there. But I'll just show you the data that we have. This is done now for glass beads of various sizes. Here are the velocity profiles, which all are pretty good exponentials, are plotted as function of distance to the inner cylinder. Here the plot is function of distance to the inner cylinder, rescaled by the diameter of the grains. And that's not a very good collapse. And it seems to work reasonably well where you do a square root. And I don't know, you know, it's somewhere in between. I don't know how serious I should take this square root. But this means that if I change my particle size, that my exponential decay rate doesn't scale in the obvious way. And this is not at all what I had expected. And it also means that there must be another length scale there. Because in
that's not a dimensionless.
No, exactly. So there must be another length scale. That's precisely what I'm saying. So what is the other length scale? It's the radius of curvature, it seems. So if you now, you know, because again, we have the problem. We have all these particles with different sizes, but you don't know precisely what the sizes are. So it's difficult to rescale. But what I can do is do the same experiment with the same glass beads, but for different radii of the inner cylinder. And this you cannot read, but this is for two cases. In one case, the inner cylinder is 20 millimeters, and the other, it's 40 millimeters. And here, this is for 2 millimeter beads. And it turns out now, if I want to rescale these ones, I have to rescale them with roughly the square root of the radius of my cylinder, right? And so the upshot of this is that what seems to happen is that the asymptotic exponential decay here, essentially the length scale there, is a combination of the radius of curvature and the particle size. So it's the square root of the product. That's dimensionally correct. And you know, it could also be, you know, d to the 1/3 times the inner radius to the 2/3 or something like that. But it's a mix of these two. And so that means that the radius of curvature plays a role for the shear zones near the inner wall, right? There it really determines precisely what its spatial profile is. And I think that's sort of surprising. So we get an exponential tail and we get this length scale. I'll try to be very brief about the 3D case. I'll skip all of this. This is our poor man's tomography. So we wanted to know, of course, what happens inside. And so what we did, as this thing suggests, you just, you know, you have a layer of sand here, you make a pattern like this with colored particles, you put another layer of sand on it, you turn it, you take a vacuum cleaner and suck off this top layer and very carefully try to recover this thing. It's quite a hassle, and I thought it would be quite simple, and in the end it took us months to get it sort of into a reasonable measurement. Because of course you don't want to disturb your grains, and you have to figure out that you don't have transients and da-da-da-da-da. In the end, you can get reasonable data. So what you get now, and the way you do it is that you know, you don't really care precisely about these wobbles here, because what you do, you correlate this picture with this picture, right? And then you get velocity profiles out. And these are now velocity profiles for one value of the surface height, but for different layers in between. And you get, you know, you get something that looks, again, error function-like, but of course, you know, no six decades. So I cannot tell you what it asymptotically looks like, but I don't see any big changes. But I can look now at the center location. This is the most interesting thing. And so if you look at the center location, and it's the easiest way to represent it is just geometrically like this, what this picture means is if I have a surface at this height, my blue curve tells me where the center of my shear zone is. But then for this height, these crosses tell me where the shear zone in the material is. So the location of the shear zone in the material doesn't follow this simple scaling law that I see at the surface. And, you know, why shoot it? There's no reason for it. Actually, what happens is that close to the surface, the thing is more or less stratified. And then, you know, for instance, if I take a layer this deep, this is in the bulk where my shear zone is. And, you know, we had been working on this for months and months, and we finally had this data, and I presented it at a meeting. And then after the talk, a guy came up to me, Thomas Unger, and he said, I think I have a scaling argument for that location. And it's very simple, and I'm still annoyed that I didn't think of it first. But basically what you do is the following. You say, well, let's now ignore that these shear zones are very wide. Let's just pretend that they're very narrow. And what I can do then, you know, what my scaling relation tells me, once I know this length scale, the slip radius, and the surface height I know where my location is. So let's put a virtual plane here, and let's just pretend, well, here now I have a system which is this height and this slip radius. For this height and this slip radius, I can predict where my top position is. And so by inverting the scaling relation, you can actually get a prediction of where the shear zone in the bulk is. Right? And it works well, you know, it works well in the sense that, you know, my data isn't better than this, but this is work by Unger and Kertész and Turek and Wolf. So this is again as a function of height. Now in the bulk, this is sort of what you see at the surface. These are the things what you get from the scaling relation. And it works, you know, good enough. You know, my data isn't better than that. So you can understand this shape quite well.
Would you say the profiles are vertical at the surface?
Yeah, that's.
Wouldn't you expect that with symmetry?
Yeah. Well, and I also think with stresses, because there's.
Yeah,
you know,
that's it. The zero stress.
Yeah.
The boundary conditions to achieve that.
Yeah, you can think of it different ways, but this is indeed what you see. And actually, experimentally, you know, we had seen that before, because actually the way you see that is if the material is running, you just take a little stick, you stick it in the sand, and you see in which direction it falls over. You get some idea of what the gradients are. It works actually reasonably well. So so that we can measure still, but in the bulk is a lot harder. And I should say now also at this point that you know, you know, MRI measurements that I did with Paul Munauer and also in the Chicago group have more or less confirmed these velocity profiles. And actually, this is still, I think, more accurate than what you can do with MRI. MRI is really difficult. So it's not so bad after all. Now, just we already talked a little bit about models. So this is a very simple model. Then actually, this model is a little bit more elaborate. So what these authors also did was say, well, again, ignoring the width of my shear zone, just trying to think with sort of in a more Coulomb way. So think as these shear zones, essentially still try to see them as very narrow. And so that means that I now just in my system somewhere have a sheet along which all the shear takes place. And if I now assume that I have hydrostatic pressure, and I assume that, you know, along this sheet, basically my shear stresses are proportional now to the hydrostatic pressure, I can minimize the total amount of torque that I have as a function of the shape of the sheet. And so this is torque minimization. So what you do, you minimize this integral. You know, without going into any details, what you get is as a function of height, you get essentially this dashed curve, which you may or may not can see. And this blue curve is the 5/2 scaling law. And so here I compare now my data again to these two different predictions. So before I always spoke about where sort of omega is a half, so that's where my RC is. And that data fits my scaling law better than the one that you get here. But an alternative way to think about it is say, well, here I look at angular velocities, but you could also look at where the strain rate, real dimensional strain rate, is maximal. So instead of looking at the radial derivative of omega, you should look at the radial derivative of the azimuthal velocity. And that gives you a slightly different center location. And I don't know if it's an accident or not, but that one fits actually the theoretical prediction reasonably well, up to deep layers. So, you know, this is all quite subtle, but it means that somehow a very simple argument gives you some important aspects of the system. It doesn't give you the velocity profile, of course, but it gives you the location pretty precisely, even though it's probably not entirely correct. Also, this torque minimalization predicts that if you go to deep layers, that the shear zones will close below the surface. And that's, of course, in a sense, what we also see, although in our case it's tremendously smeared out, because for these deep layers my shear zones become extremely wide. But so the basic physics is there, just by essentially doing something like more Coulomb, but, you know, it's not enough. And there's just one riddle that I will try to give very short, and I'm willing to discuss it with you after the talk. That is, when you start to think about what would happen in a linear system. So I want to get rid of all these curvature effects, because they're really a headache. So just imagine that you have a system where you shear like this. And so if you look, you know, based on the scaling law, et cetera, that we have, what you would expect is just a very symmetric shear zone here. And based on the 3D data that we have, we know that sort of the planes of constant velocity are like this. And so here you have the planes along which the material is sliding, and here there's no sliding. And now if you think about this little cube here, and you try to get force balance, and you also at the same time try to balance the shear stresses, you see that the ratio between shear stresses and normal stresses is not a constant. It cannot be a constant for these sort of shapes to occur. And so this would be the most basic assumption if you try to do some sort of more Coulomb type description now for wide shear zones, and it has to fail there. It only has to fail maybe by a few percent, but apparently this is what you need to get wide shear zones of this shape. And so there is now really something to think about, is to figure out what are the stresses in systems like this, and you know, what is the ratio between normal and shear stresses. I think that is one way to try to understand these profiles.
You need to get the profile to spread out. You need something with like viscosity.
Well, it's not so much a spreading out. I mean, if the thing would look like this, so one of them is concave and one be, well, whatever. I mean, if it looks like this, you can still get it consistent with a constant ratio between normal and shear stresses. But the fact that it's curved like that, then it doesn't work anymore. I mean, I don't want to get into much details because I get confused about it myself. And I should also say, which I forgot, and this is work by Martin Depkin, who's a postdoc in Leiden, who's trying to figure this out. And, you know, basically trying to set up based on the fact that we now have wide shear zones, which seem to be quasi-static and seem to be on a continuum scale, you know, how do I think about the strain rates and the stresses in a system like this? And so there are riddles. And so I want to end with some colorful pictures. Which is always a good thing to do. You know, with MRI you can try to measure the velocity inside the material, and it's pretty hard. But MRI is of course made in a sense to measure densities. So what we did here is looking essentially at what is the packing density of your grains. And so the way it works is that you take poppy seeds, which you can see in an MRI, and you have a system here where you have now a disc here at the bottom. And now in this case the disc is turned, and I should tell you the disc is actually turned by hand because the MRI people don't allow us to have a motor anywhere near their machine. And actually there are some experiments where there are 1024 turns, and there was actually a guy sitting there, you know. It's a bit, again, it's a bit primitive, but what you learn from it is quite interesting. So it's difficult to get an absolute packing density out. So what we do is just we take a snapshot of the system where we just filled it up, then rotate it, first for a quarter turn, then for a half turn, etc., etc., get other snapshots, and divide these two. And they sort of give you a relative packing density. And so what you find is that, you know, here is my disk, and so here is roughly where my shear zone is, and this is all consistent with what I've shown you. I don't know precisely what happens at the top here, but this at least seems to work fine. And now look at the ratio, the density ratio. So in the shear zone, you're roughly 15% less dense than outside. And you know, this is really the density ratio between random close and random loose packing, roughly. So what happens really, as we know, if you shear material, it has to dilate. But what is the nice thing now is since I have these very wide shear zones, I can see how much it dilates. And it really goes as much as it more or less can. And another thing which is nice is that if you keep on turning, of course here at the edges, you know, there's only a very small strain rate. So if you just turn the system a little bit, you haven't picked up enough strain to dilate the system completely. If you keep on turning, this dilated zone slowly spreads out. And so actually what you can do, you can also look at one fixed point here and then see how the density increases. And basically what you find is that the density increases linearly with a slope which is essentially given by the strain rate. The density decreases linearly and then hits sort of a minimum value and then levels off. So essentially what happens if you're somewhere in the system, you just pick up strain, you know, until you get that sort of, and you dilate until the strain is maybe of order, you know, of order the grain scale or something like that, and then you don't dilate any further. And what is a big puzzle to me is that this thing is sort of slowly spreading out and dilating, but if I look at my velocity profiles, I never see any aging or change over time. And so I don't understand how velocity and density couple here. This is puzzling. This is a polydispersed system. These are poppy seeds, so you know it's messy.
Sorry?
probably different random flows and random loops.
I don't define it. I just say that roughly these things roughly look spherical, and the ratio between the two is roughly this. I don't have absolute densities, but just to give an idea that it's actually it's dilating a lot. That's all I want to say.
That's called Gauss random loop spectrum.
Yes, that's what I think, but I don't know how close it is. You know, if it's 1% away from it, you know, nobody knows what random loose packing is in any case. So you know, but it becomes pretty damn loose, and it's more than I would have guessed naively.
So you said that, so the velocities reach steady state much quicker than the density.
Yes, and I don't really understand how that works. And it could be that essentially all this dilation happens very far in the tails of the velocity profiles. This is something that I just have to check, and we haven't done that. Or there's something else going on, and I don't understand.
I mean, yeah, because if the density changes to do with the strain, then of course it will be much, much slower.
Well, it may be something like that. So I don't know precisely. So there could still be some very subtle things going on in the tails, but this is precisely, you know, when your grains have moved less than one grain diameter, you cannot measure much velocity. So it's okay. So I think that's more than enough. So if you split the bottom in your shear cell, you can get lots of different flows. And I've shown you these three regimes: a shallow regime where I get very universal results, a deep regime which in the disk geometry I get this precession and global modes, and if I put an inner cylinder there I get localization. All of them have some surprises. There's lots of dilation, which is interesting. And the thing really now to do, apart from of course more experiments, because there's always something you could do experimentally, is do more MD. There are already a couple of MD simulations by the group of Gary Grest, and also Stefan Looney has done some MD, and they all sort of reproduce what we find. But what we really want to understand is precisely what do the stresses look like, what is the role of fluctuations, what is the role of the latency, etc., etc. And really what the hope is, and it may be a bit naive hope, but you know, for this system you seem to have some sort of chance to get a continuum description. And that would be really, really nice. So that's what we're aiming for.
That's beautiful, beautiful work. Did you say something about the nature of the particles? You described it, you referred to it as sand, but what did you really mean?
For just the ordinary, my ordinary experiments?
Yeah, for the ones you've been describing.
Yeah, this okay, yeah, not the MRI. Okay, so we've used the sort of standard glass beads in different sizes. We also did some experiments with these bronze powders, which are much more irregular, right? And then at some point we decided, okay, just buy all sort of weird stuff. So my students went to the garden center and came back with different sort of sand and bird seeds, and we tried most of them. And if they were not too big, some of the bird seeds were really too big, so it didn't work. You essentially find the same results.
So I'm really asking whether it was monodisperse or polydisperse.
No, it doesn't seem to matter. I mean, I think, for instance, we saw things when you at some point I thought, well, you know, is it important that they're spherical or not? So I tried to do it with rice grains, and it's a little bit difficult to say because they're quite big. And so you know, the main thing I learned is that actually if you put 2 kilos of basmati rice in your setup, that it really smells nice. I hadn't realized that, but if you shear it, it's wonderful. You know, roughly all the phenomena seem to be the same. You know, one thing that happens for these very rough and asymmetric particles, it seems that you get more corrugation of your surface, so your surface is not entirely flat anymore, and you get small convection effects setting in. Roughly the phenomena are the same, and if there are, you know, but I can't tell you any systematics. But it's certainly, if you do it with glass beads or a little bit more like angular sand, it all seems to work fine. Well, thank you. Sorry. No, not in 3D. No. And also, well, our particles are never, well, I think actually for the large glass bead they're monodispersed enough, but no, that doesn't happen. No.
How have you tried to measure the height of the surface very closely?
We're looking at that now because you should see this dilation, of course, right? And you do. Problem is that, you know, you're looking at, you know, this dilation in the shear zone is 15%, but for the total system is maybe 1%, right? And then it may be slightly inhomogeneous, and you have your particle scale, so it's not so easy to figure out how precisely to do that. Essentially, you can just look at with a video camera from the side, and you pick up sort of the dilation, but you don't know what you're precisely looking at, because the thing is not entirely flat. In any case, the surface, you know, is sort of corrugated, certainly on the grain scale, right? So
there might be some
shape.
Yeah, there probably is some.
There is a little. Yeah, there is some shape there, and so the easiest way to see that is looking with a laser sheet or something like that, and you. Although, you know, with glass beads, it's always hard to imagine something. And you see that there's something there, but I, you know, I'm not really going to pursue that because I don't know
what would interest. If you had a camera, it would be easy to do with stereo.
Well, everything is easy to do if you... No, it would take me a couple of months and I would get some profile out, but then what? I know already what I get out. I get a little dip. So what should I connect it to? Right? I mean, I...
Well, it matches up with the pressure in some sense.
I'm not so sure.
There has to be some force balance.
But I think there near the surface you will not find out what's happening. What you would like to know really is what happens in the bulk. And I think we're at this point a little bit at the stage that you know, unless we start to do this with index match particles in fluid and really measure the velocity profile, which I would love to do, even then I cannot measure the pressures and the stresses inside. And I think there really MD has to come in. And at least, you know, the experiments give you pretty stringent tests for your MD. You know, it's not like we want a profile that looks like this. I tell you precisely what it is within a percent or less. And if you don't get it out of your MD, I'm not interested. So hopefully, you know, this will, yeah, put the pressure on a little bit.
Can I pick up on one little aside you mentioned, which was just if you stop the ribbon shear.
Yeah.
And reverse the drive, and you commented that it actually initially undilates.
That's a thing. Yeah, no. It recompacts. It recompacts. It cannot get more dilated, right? It recompacts.
No, it undilates.
Oh, undilates. Sorry. Yeah.
I mean, an experiment literally on the beach.
Right.
Checking the reversibility of angle of rest.
Yeah.
Something analogous that if you flow something down, down slope to rest and then look at the angle of rest for backflow, again, there's just a little bit of response.
Right.
Relatively shallow
right.
angle going back, which I think is analogous.
Right.
Says a lot about the flow.
Right. Well, I should also say that there are more serious experiments on that in the sense that for ordinary Couette cells, Wolfgang Losert has done quite some work on that. And so if you reverse the direction, you can both see the recompaction. And also, you know, for the Couette cells, of course, asymptotically, your velocity profile is very much localized. But when you reverse the flow for a while, you have a very broad zone where everything is rearranging. So, but it tells you indeed. And it's also, you know, it's actually a nice thing. I do this when I have students in the lab. So you rotate it one direction, then you stop, and you say, okay, so now I can, you don't see anything in this system, but it knows which direction it has been turning. If you continue in the same direction, you don't see anything. And so all of these things that are also there, there's strong anisotropies in my system, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that's, of course, the really interesting part, but cannot measure it. Coffee, maybe?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.